Let's change up the way you watch baseball. Introducing Change Up, a brand new live whip-around show across the league, brought to you by MLB and DAZN. Jump in and out of the best places they happen and get expert analysis from hosts who bring a fresh personality and a new perspective to the game. It's on every night and available on nearly any device, smart TVs, tablet, mobile, and gaming consoles. Getting set up with DAZN is easy. Just download the DAZN app in the Apple or Android App Store, sign up by creating an account, and start watching across any of your devices. That's DAZN. Hello and welcome to the Ringer MLB show. My name is Michael Bauman. I am a staff writer at the Ringer. The MLB draft is ongoing, so please check out Zach's story on new White Sox first baseman Andrew Vaughn and mine on new Orioles catcher Adley Rutschman. I'm going to talk about the draft with Eric Longenhagen of Fangraphs later on in the show. Also ongoing, Ben's new book with Travis Sawchick, The MVP Machine, comes out today. There's an excerpt of the book on the site if you want to try it before you buy, although I would encourage you to go and patronize your nearest bookseller to acquire a copy as soon as possible. Ben and I are going to discuss the book later on the show as well. Also, I want to get out in front of this. During that segment, I said I'd stop saying "you know." That's a verbal pause. And then I said "you know" at least twice between when I said that and the end of the podcast. So I want to apologize for my hubris. But before we get to all of that, we've got to check in with the actual goings-on in Major League Baseball. So let's do that. Let's do the news with Zach Cram. So later on the show, we're going to talk about how players come to enter the professional ranks with Eric Longenhagen of Fangraphs, and we're going to talk about how they get shaped into competitive big leaguers with Ben Lindberg. But first, let's just talk about the state of Major League Baseball as it is. And for that purpose, I am pleased to be joined, as always, by Zach Cram. Zach.
Hello.
Let's talk about, there's news. There's a trade. So let's start with Jay Bruce, traded from the Seattle Mariners to the Philadelphia Phillies for minor leaguer Jake Schiener and about $18 million, or $18 million, I should say, which covers all but about $3 million of the year and a half left on Bruce's contract. Whatever. I guess that's like a rough summation of the thing we're leading off the show with, but this is just sort of moving pieces around.
Yeah, and I think the more important element it has is that it symbolizes the start of trade season, which we usually say, oh, front offices are concerned about the draft, and then after the draft, they can shift their focus and actually think about this season and making improvements or selling, depending on their situation. So the fact that the Jay Bruce trade came basically just before the draft happened just resonated even more clearly in my mind with this being the turning point. Now we can start thinking about, all right, where might Madison Bumgarner go? Is Marcus Stroman going to be traded? And so on, because there are presumably more impactful names and players who will be traded than Jay Bruce.
Yeah, and from the Phillies' perspective, this trade, it comes to sort of fill a need, because the Phillies do need help in the outfield. This is not the most important side effect of Odubel Herrera's leave after being arrested on suspicion of domestic violence, and presumably he'll be suspended at some point. And Andrew McCutchen injured himself on Monday night after the trade went through. So they have a hole in center field, but now more playing time in the corners, which I imagine will be where Bruce fits in. They're also kind of a right-handed heavy lineup. You know, Realmuto and Michael Franco and Rhys Hoskins provide a lot of pop from that side. And Bryce Harper is, sort of stands alone as a lefty. So insofar as Bruce is useful, that is where he's probably going to fit in. Schiener is, no, intending no disrespect to him, not somebody the Phillies are going to really miss. $3 million is something that they're perfectly capable of paying for a fourth outfielder / backup first baseman, and will not impact their ability to go out and get a pitcher, which I expect them to do between now and the trade deadline. As far as the Mariners go, I guess this just, they got a minor leaguer. They got off some of the money. Bruce was never going to be in their long-term plans anyway.
Do you remember when they were, 13-2, when people were wondering if they keep this up, are they going to continue with their plans to reload? And definitely, they are now 25-38. They're in last place in the American League West, and I think it's pretty clear that their hot start will not interfere with any long-term plans they might have had.
No. I think we called that one pretty correctly at the time. We had Meg on the show and she said, well, let's talk about this now before it goes away. And it did pretty rapidly. So, this is certainly a big name. But at this point, you remember Jason Giambi got signed every offseason by one team and moved around, got traded every July. Jim Thome, the same thing for a couple of years. This is maybe not that quality of career, but I think a similar role that you would expect Jay Bruce to play.
I mean, it's his third time in the last four seasons that he's moved midseason. So a pretty impressive pattern he's collecting.
He's collecting a lot. He's seeing the world, man. You know, there's something to be said for that. I think that, one thing that I always found interesting about the life cycle of a professional athlete is those athletes who, and maybe Jay Bruce isn't this guy because he's been traded so many times, but there is an opportunity to like experience a lot of different things if you're just sort of bouncing around at the end of your career. You know, like if you're the aging soccer player who goes and plays in China for a year and then comes to MLS and goes to the Middle East or something like that. I think there's something attractive about that if you know, you're wired that way as a player and a personality. So
Philadelphia, as far afield as China and the Middle East.
You could make that argument. It's that far afield for somebody. All right, let's move on to, you want to talk about the Texas Rangers. I want to talk a little bit about the Colorado Rockies. These are two teams that have sort of moved into, they moved from also-ran status to slightly less also-ran. Like you could see them maybe not closing down the teams they're chasing because the Dodgers and Astros have been so good, but they're edging their way back into their respective wildcard races.
Yeah, and I think these two teams have a lot of similarities in my mind in terms of how they're constructed. They are pretty much led by their offense in an offensively oriented ballpark, but their starting pitching outside the top two has been abysmal for both teams. In Colorado, you have Herman Marquez, who's built on his hot run at the end of last season. John Gray has pretty much bounced back from last year. But beyond them, the Rockies rotation has taken giant
Kyle
steps
Freeland
backward.
Went from fourth in Cy Young voting to ERA of 7. How did this happen?
Yeah, he was demoted. And then in Texas, you have kind of a similar orientation.
Mike, I'm going to make you say the name. Say the name.
Lance Lynn.
Yes. Who,
I know this is funny because Michael does not necessarily believe in FIP. He is more of he is more of an ERA guy. But Lance Lynn, his ERA is 4.5, which is not great. His FIP is 3.17, and if you look at FanGraphs' pitching WAR, which is based on FIP, Lance Lynn is the sixth most valuable pitcher in baseball this year, sandwiched between Marquez and Hyunjin Ryu. So Lance Lynn has been incredible. Mike Minor has been quietly one of the better pitchers in baseball for a year and a half now, but also they have nobody beyond those two either. I can't really see Texas especially keeping this up. Joey Gallo is out for a bit now after injuring, I think, his oblique over the weekend, which is a bummer because he's been a terror this season. Mm-hmm. So I can definitely see Texas falling out as soon as we talk about them. But right now, they're in the second wildcard spot, and that's a pretty impressive start.
Yeah, let's talk about them while they're there.
Yeah, exactly. A team that I think nobody really assumed would compete, especially in that division. Oakland seemed like a better team. The Angels seemed like a better team. Maybe even Seattle. Texas is in second place right now.
Yeah, the two guys who I think really exemplify what's happening in Texas are Hunter Pence and Mike Minor. They've got a lot of these players who, like, this would have been one of the best teams in baseball in 2012 or so. Just the number of old guys they brought in to do a job while they figure out what they're doing long term. And Hunter Pence has been awesome. He's hitting 303, 349, 599, which even in that ballpark is a 139 OPS plus. I thought he was cooked. And the same thing with, Minor was sort of bouncing around as a reliever. And we had that on our prop bets episode. I had that which Vanderbilt pitcher will end up leading Major League Baseball in strikeouts. And the options were, I think, David Price, Walker Buehler, and the field. And Mike Minor's making the field look pretty good right now.
And it's not just those guys, like Logan Forsyth.
Mm-hmm.
You know what Logan Forsyth's on base percentage right now is? It's 406. And Logan Forsyth was terrible for the Dodgers last season. They traded him for an incremental upgrade to Brian Dozier. He's been great. Danny Santana's had a resurgence after not playing in the majors for a couple years. Asdrubal Cabrera hasn't been great, but at least he's hit decently and been able to play in the lineup at a position of need. So it's kind of the rebuilding route where you just sign a bunch of veterans to one-year deals and hope it sticks. And at least for 2 months it has. It could certainly help if they had more prospects to call up. And I don't think at Texas's developmental cycle right now, they really have that like AAA ammunition, especially on the pitching side, but it's been fun to watch.
And here's like, I think Bruce is a pretty good example of what you might expect, like a, you know, a fringy prospect and maybe a little bit of salary relief if you're looking to trade a guy like that at the deadline, but that's not nothing. Like you can get sometimes the guy who you get back for a rental, like hits his 90th percentile upside. So they've given themselves between, even if this doesn't keep up and they wind up trading most of these players, Pence would bring them something back. Minor might be one of the best short-term pitching acquisitions a team could make. They could get something serious for him at the deadline if this goes south, or they could wind up sneaking into the second wild card and starting Mike Minor against Tampa or Boston. Wouldn't that be something to see?
If only there were a pitcher who were known for succeeding in Texas who might be available, if only.
So you want to talk about that now?
I guess now that the draft has started,
let's not shortchange the Rockies, because that was we were going to make that a piece. The Colorado Rockies are a team that looked like they were in a spiral. Jeff Breidich came out against beat writers in general, or was quoted in a book that came out last week. The comments he made were published, and then since then they've been on an 8-game winning streak. During that 8-game streak, Trevor Story, Nolan Arenado, David Dahl, and Ian Desmond have all hit 391 or better, have all slugged 677 or better. And that is the proverbial ball game. If that happens over a week, you're probably going to win most, if not all, of your games.
The National League is shaping up I'm envisioning it sort of in a few tiers, where I think the Dodgers are a tier unto themselves in the National League, by far the best team. And then you have, I guess, the Cubs, Brewers, Phillies, and Braves form a second tier. But then after that, you have a bunch of teams who are all potentially in the mix. I wouldn't bet on a single one of them to make the playoffs. But among that group, it's easy to see one of them emerging. And that's the Mets, the Nationals, the Cardinals, the Pirates, the Reds, the Rockies, the Padres, the Diamondbacks, basically
everybody but the Marlins and Giants.
Yeah,
I think it's still in it. Yeah,
kind of in that situation where any one of them, if they have a hot week, can make us think they're the new flavor. Colorado obviously has made the playoffs a couple seasons in a row, so maybe they're better positioned from that respect. But looking at this roster, it just doesn't seem strong enough to continue.
Well, one option available to them, I'm going to just completely rip off your segue and say one option available to them is Dallas Keuchel, who looks like finally, now that the draft is over, that the draft pick compensation is out of the way, looks like he could sign with a team in the next, I don't know, maybe as soon as the next couple days. The Braves and the Yankees have been rumored to be two of the front runners. Keuchel, if he goes to the Yankees, would have to cut off his signature beard, which would be very interesting. He has a fascinating chin underneath all that beard, which we haven't seen said chin since his time at the University of Arkansas. So, I mean, just for curiosity's sake, I'm rooting for him to sign with the Yankees.
The Keuchel story has gone on for so long, and maybe we can group Craig Kimbrel in here too, because both of them are still free agents, but the excuses have generated new excuses, and we predicted this back when it seemed like Keuchel and Kimbrel were not going to sign. The excuse was going to become, oh, well, there's no point signing now because we can wait until the draft and not lose compensation. Oh, well, now that the draft is over, we might not want to sign them now because they haven't pitched in 2 months and they won't be able to get in shape for a while. And there was some reporting to that effect over the weekend. Obviously, if the Yankees or Braves are going to sign Keuchel right away, maybe that's not as much of a concern. But it's been frustrating how predictably frustrating this is, if that makes sense, that we could see this coming from months away.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. The predictably frustrating, the fact that we knew exactly what was going to happen doesn't make it any less annoying. And I just think that you're out of excuses. If you're going to sign one of these players, and I don't know, I'm looking at the list of contenders, can you name a team that let's even assume that Keuchel is nothing more than a three, maybe a good number four starter in a playoff rotation? Where's the contender that couldn't use that? You know, where's the contender that couldn't use even a shaky version of Craig Kimbrel? Even if you're absolutely the most pessimistic you can possibly be, almost every team has room under the luxury tax to go and get one of these players now. And if you don't sign them now, that just gives them less of a chance to warm up and get up to speed and get to full strength for the playoff run. So,
especially because if, let's even take that at face value, it'll take Keuchel a month to get up to full speed. That means you're adding him to the rotation in mid-July, which is the time you traditionally want to add a starting pitcher anyway. How many pitchers will be available who are better than Keuchel? And if they are, then that means they will cost an exorbitant prospect haul, whereas Keuchel is basically just looking for a one-year deal at this point. And yep. The same thing goes for Kimbrel that you mentioned with Keuchel in the rotation, where Craig Kimbrel, even if you're not signing him to be a closer, who knows if he would do that, but it's not like you're bumping your closer. It's you're taking the seventh guy in your bullpen out and moving every other pitcher down a notch. That means you're comparing Kimbrel to the seventh best pitcher in a bullpen. Even the Yankees could use Kimbrel over the seventh guy in the bullpen. So I'm excited for them to sign just so we can stop making this argument over and over again. But the fact that it's lasted so long has meant we've had to.
Well, if you're out there listening, you own an MLB team, you can hire Zach and me to run your team, and we will win you. We will get you to the playoffs by doing obvious things correctly. That is our promise here to you at Cram and Bauman Analytics Firm, which I need to call my lawyer and get the papers drawn up so we can actually found this company.
I guess it's refreshing that in an era where we're concerned that front offices have become so smart and what can we as public analysts add, saying sign one of the best closers in baseball history is still, you know, worthy to count as advice.
His great learning hath made him mad. I think will be an interesting bookend with my discussion later on with Ben about his book about all the ways, you know, all the really impressive ways in which major league front offices have gotten smarter, and not only front offices, but players and private coaches. Like, there's so much intelligence in the game out there, and there's just no appetite to go and sign a recent Cy Young winner. Is it surprising? Is it telling? What adjective would you choose?
I don't know. I almost think it's put me in a strange position, because entering the offseason, I was thinking, I'm not quite sure about Keuchel's future. He's not the same pitcher he was when he won the Cy Young in 2015. He seems more like a three or four back end guy. He's not the best pitcher in baseball, but he doesn't have to be for teams to sign him. So I've almost become more defensive of his abilities. And Kimbrel, same thing. We were all concerned about his shaky postseason run, but he's still one of the best pitchers, one of the best closers in baseball history. And he's not old. He can still throw the ball pretty hard. He's hard to hit. It's not like he needs to be prime Mariano Rivera for the next 5 years to be worth a contract. So I've almost become more defensive of them than I would have been in the offseason. So I'm not sure if telling is the right adjective, just frustrating all the way around. Frankly, I didn't expect to go on a rant like this today. So that's a new thing for me on this podcast, for all the major league GMs listening to me, apparently. But that's the situation we're in. And again, I'm just hoping they sign soon and it can get resolved, and we can go back to watching the game's best players actually play.
I almost forget that they're out there. It's just so bizarre that two players of that quality haven't signed yet.
It's actually the opposite for me. Like, every single time a team like the Cubs or Red Sox or Braves blows a game in the eighth or ninth inning, I remember, well, they could have had Kimbrel. And every single time that a team throws out a bad fifth starter and gets pounded, I think, well, they could have had Keuchel. And obviously that's not fair, because one, that would only apply to one team. And it's not like adding Craig Kimbrel.
Hey man, until one team does it, I feel like it's fair to you to levy that criticism against every team that has the opportunity.
But yeah, and sure, adding Craig Kimbrel to the Cubs bullpen would not solve all of their bullpen problems, but it would certainly have a knockdown effect. And it's hung over the first 2 months of the season like a cloud for me, actually. I haven't forgotten about them at all. So maybe that's why I'm so looking forward to this cloud being removed.
It's good to hear you fired up about this. I really enjoyed it. Hopefully we'll We will have at least one of them signed by the time we reconvene next week. And if that happens, I'll talk to you about it then. Thanks for coming on.
Thank you.
How often do you think about your socks? If you're like I used to be, not much, but I recently discovered socks that changed the way I think about socks forever. They're called Bombas. I used to be a boring, solid-colored socks person, but it turns out you can get not only greater style, but comfort and durability with Bombas. I am thinking about my socks now, because Bombas are the most comfortable socks in the history of feet. They're made from super soft, natural cotton, and every pair comes with arch support, a seamless toe, and a cushioned footbed that's comfy but not too thick. With many colors, patterns, lengths, and styles, Bombas look great in the gym, at the office, and out on the town. Bombas are what feet daydream about. And best of all, for every Bombas purchase you make, Bombas donates a pair to someone in need. So you buy your Bombas at bombas.com/MLB today, get 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/MLB for 20% off. bombas.com/MLB. All right. I am very happy to be joined right now by my good friend and a man who knows the meaning of the phrase, there is no rest for the weary, Fangraph's lead prospect analyst, Eric Longenhagen. How you doing?
Doing good. But you're right. It's take a guess of what time I went to bed last night.
I mean, I know you've called me like in the middle of the night, my time on draft night in years past. So I can't imagine this is any different, particularly now with Kylie keeping you up.
Well, yeah, Kylie went to bed at like, I don't know, it was probably close to 1 or 2 his time in Atlanta. And I know it's time to go to bed when I see like Gammons and Buster Olney tweeting, like waking up on the East Coast.
That's rough.
but yeah, we got the, you know, the day one preview's got to go up first thing in the morning. So, but it's fun. Like I wouldn't trade it. This week is intense, but it's so much fun.
Well, I'm glad you put in the work because I have consumed your day one draft review and mean to ask you questions about it. So let's get started. I guess my big concern, storyline I was following just had to do with the number one pick because Rutschman was so far out in front of everybody else. And I was a little concerned that the Orioles would try to do something cute and they didn't. They picked him and then Bobby Witt went off the board second. And then Andrew Vaughn and J.J. Bleday and so on. And there wasn't really a surprising pick for at least the first 6 or 7.
Right, yeah. It seemed like, you know, any of the chatter surrounding what Baltimore was going to do at 1 felt to us like it was just leveraging, like, to try to get Rutschman's number down a little bit so they could do something else interesting with some of the later picks rather than just go slot all the way down the board. I think everybody that covers the draft like nailed the first 7 picks in their mock. So it was pretty chalky last night early on. And only at pick 8 is really where we felt discomfort when the draft started with like what we thought was going to happen there.
So pick 8 is Josh Jung, the Texas Tech infielder. So what do you think that's something the Rangers are going to go under slot with him or do you think that they just valued him as the 8th best player in the draft?
We're not totally sure. He's a Boris client, so it wouldn't seem as though he's a likely candidate to be under slot, but it did seem like Texas and those teams, those teams in like the 7, 8, 9 area seemed motivated to go under slot just because the top tier of talent was generally seen as 6, like the 6 guys who went off the board first. And then depending on the team, Nick Lodolo was in that mix as well. Those were the first 7 picks. And so, you know, with Texas picking at 8, it seemed as though they were motivated to cut a deal. Jung had Holmes at least at 13. And then again at 15. So it's possible that there's a little bit of a deal there, but just because of who the advisor is, I'm not sure it'll be much of one. And I guess we can watch what Texas does today now to see if it's under slot. Like if there's a run on high schoolers in the Rangers draft room today, then maybe that is under slot. And their third rounder was a righty from the University of New Mexico, Justin Slayton. So it doesn't appear that way.
Yeah, I should remind everybody listening to this that we are talking as the – are we still in the third round or we moved into the fourth?
The third round's going on right now. Yeah. Cleveland just took a a 5'10" first baseman from SoCal who's got like really good field to hit. So a kid who most of the area scouts told me was going to school. So like crazy stuff is still happening. It's just not, you know, it's just not with the big famous names anymore.
Well, that's why we have you to tell us what the, like, you know, you actually know what's going on here. So with that in mind, I was going to ask you, which team you thought had a good night. And I was looking at, your draft review and you were not that high on the Atlanta Braves who, I don't know if this is going to be surprising to you. I like that they went with Langeliers at 9 and Braden Shoemake at 21. Both of those are polished major conference up the middle college bats. This is an archetype I like a great deal, and you were a little bit down on them.
Yeah, Langeliers at 9, I think, is fine. It's a sure defensive catcher with pop. Has been really hot lately. I think he hit 19 of 20 games during conference play, and then had like, you know, an 11 RBI game during a regionals. He's just been on fire lately. Shoemake, we had ranked 54. Most teams, like we were lower on him. Most teams had him 30 to 40, and he was picked 21. So I think that one's defensible. I agree with you. He's got the frame. He's performed at a big school for 3 years. He's probably going to move pretty quickly. And then Bo Phillip was the one pick in the second round where we were like, I don't know. This is not great. He's a junior college transfer who transferred to Oregon State, replaced, Caden Grenier and Nick Madrigal were high draft picks out of Oregon State last year. They needed Damian Easley's son. Signed out of high school last year with Texas instead of going to Oregon State. So like Oregon State needed middle infield help. Bo Phillip transferred from a junior college to Oregon State. Played okay. His numbers are just okay. They're not like second round college performer stats. Like it's not a reason you take a guy in the second round if his stats look like Bo Phillip's. But he's got bat speed. And Atlanta, you know, there are elements of the Houston front office in Atlanta's now. This is probably a swing change candidate. This is someone who's got like bat speed and a chance to stay in the middle infield, but needs a better swing. So, a speculative like player dev pick here with Bo Phillip, in my opinion, like if you're trying to find a way to justify it, that's how I think you go about doing it. But yeah, I was not huge on Atlanta's draft, in general. But I do think Langeliers is good.
So who did do well? Who were the, I asked this fully aware of how ridiculous it is to ask you who won the draft while the third round is still ongoing. But yeah, you know, first impressions.
The D-backs, just because there are so many picks, I thought they got a good mix of high school with upside. Blake Walston, high school lefty from North Carolina, really popped up this spring. He's got a frame, a breaking ball. He's young for the class. Brennan Malone, another power-armed high school pitcher, has been up to 99, good slider. And then the college pitching they took is all like, pitch design friendly guys. It's guys with vertical arm slots and vertical action on their breaking balls. That is like the modern in vogue pitching like characteristic is like pure backspin on your four-seamer. All these guys have it. So I liked Arizona's draft. I thought Baltimore did well. I mean, they took the best guy. And then I like their next two picks too. Gunnar Henderson at 42 feels safer to me than a prep arm would have. He's also young for the class, has power, arm strength, probably fits at third base. His name was being mentioned as high as like the middle to late first round. At least there were some teams kind of kicking the tires on that. So that was pretty interesting to me. I like the Angels draft too. Will Wilson and Kyren Paris, they're both, again, young for the class. Will Wilson is he's not yet 21 as a college draftee, middle infielder with power. Kyren Paris is like just straight up like the youngest player in the draft. It's a big framed shortstop who's just 17 and a half. He's closer in age to a lot of the July 2nd kids on the international market than he is to even some of the other high school kids in this draft. It's too young. These probably draft model driven, upboard players. I thought they did well. And then Miami, I liked two of the three picks. I don't think Cameron Meisner can hit, but he's got a huge power. The other two guys, J.J. Bleda is like a slam dunk, quick moving, everyday corner outfielder for me. And then Nassim Nunez, their second rounder, is the best defensive shortstop in the class. And a switch hitter with athleticism, like chance to do something with the bat. But mostly it's the glove. Those are the teams that, you know, just as I'm scrolling through, I'm like, they did very well. And then like the Phillies to get Bryson Stott at 14, they had one pick. I just think that was good value.
That's comforting. I sort of have my heart set on Rutledge, but I defer to your wisdom on this.
Yeah. With Rutledge, like, I don't know. I get it. It's a 6 foot seven, 260 pound dude who throws in the upper 90s with 2+ breaking balls. There's some medical stuff there that I think caused him to fall. It has been reported elsewhere, like that he has hip issues.
And having said that, big hard throwing pitcher with injury concerns, where did he go? The Washington Nationals. So
correct. Yeah. Yep. Seems like their MO.
Yeah. And it's worked out okay for them so far. So, yeah. You know.
Yeah, that's one of the things, like some of these teams just don't care about pitcher injury. Like they just seem to assume that everyone who throws the baseball has about an equal chance of getting injured. And that's how, you know, the Dodgers end up with Walker Buehler that way. And they've also ended up with lots of guys you haven't heard of because they haven't done well. You know, they drafted Michael Grove last year and Morgan Cooper from Texas still hasn't thrown a pitch for them, and Mitchell White has been inconsistent. Like these are all guys who were hurt in college who the Dodgers drafted. But like if you take five of those guys and one of them is Walker Buehler, you've done
well. That's the beauty of the draft. You only need, like, the hit rate doesn't have to be that high.
Right.
So I want to go back to something you said about the Diamondbacks. They had seven picks in the top 75 last year, and classes like this are always very interesting to me because there is like a pressure when these teams, we think of what year was it that the Rays had like something like 12 picks in the top 60, or the Moneyball draft, or the Kyle Tucker, Alex Bregman, Daz Cameron draft for the Astros, that like when you have a lot of picks in the first day of the draft, there's a temptation to try to get creative, move money around, move guys up and down the board to suit you. And so like, how would you go about pursuing a, you know, if you had something like what the Diamondbacks had with just that sheer number of picks?
Right. I think as much as the number of picks in your bonus pool, I think this is the second highest bonus pool of this draft era, where the structure is like, you know, has the bonus pools and the penalties associated with it. I think that the 1 year that that Houston did like Daz Cameron and stuff is the most the team has had.
Yeah, they had 2 and 5 that year. So that's the...
Right. And then they moved Daz to like their second round pick for $5 million was his number there. It was huge. But yeah, so like it has as much to do with where your picks are as it does how many of them there are. At 16 with the D-backs, it seemed like they were just going to take whoever was good value there, whoever kind of fell to them. You know, at 16, Corbin Carroll, the Seattle area high schooler, is who we mocked to them. It's who they ended up taking, but there were other names like in play at that pick, depending on who went ahead of them. I would do a mix, right? I would do a mix of the upside and the certainty. You have to have some financial anchors in there as well. You have to have some signable college talent just to stabilize the financial situation that you have in the draft. I would probably cut a deal somewhere too with you know, an analytics driven college player. We saw Cleveland do it with Nick Sandlin, like a sidearmer submarine relief type guy with command from Southern Miss last year. And it doesn't appear that the D-backs did anything like that, but that's a thing I would look to do, is like among this group, I would take, hey, who's like the best pitchability college arm in this draft? Someone who's not going to go until the third or fourth round. Let's take this guy in like the second round comp round and cut an underslot deal and like really have a whole lot of financial flexibility with all these picks. And that's not a thing that the D-backs did, but I still like the group they had. There are all sorts of ways to approach this sort of thing.
But you would want a diversified portfolio, you know, with lack of a better way to put it.
Yeah. And some of it too is just these guys have to be on a field somewhere. In a couple weeks, you know, the AZL starts in 2 weeks. So You can only have so many, you can only have one 18-year-old shortstop on the field there. So you kind of have to spread it out just for logistical purposes too.
Mm-hmm. So you mentioned Kyren Paris being the youngest player who went off the board yesterday. And there's a lot of discussion with regard to age and high school prospects. And this is sort of, this is one of the things that you just have to contend with when you're evaluating prospects, that the players' physical, everything from the qualitative analysis to the numbers and the performance, it's all filtered through that age and the physical and skill maturation process. And there's been a lot of discussion in this draft class because there were two relatively old, two 19-year-old high school infielders who went in the top 12, in Bobby Witt and Brett Beatty. And I'm curious, whether you think that, the industry just has a good handle on this, that this is something, is this something that we need to pay more attention to? Is it overblown or is this just another data point?
It is. I think it's pretty significant. There are certainly teams who it's clear Cleveland. Cleveland ends up with one of the youngest players in the draft, at least one every year. And so there's clearly some teams who this is an influential variable in their draft model. I'm convinced that the timing of some of the Kyren Paris in the first round type buzz that we hear is when teams start to in earnest run their models, have draft meetings, and then everybody leaves the meetings and is calling us and hey, listen to these three guys who are way higher on our board than I thought they were going to be. And it's because the model is driving them up the board because of age. You could argue it's a thing that we overcorrected on as an industry. But in individual circumstances, Brett Beatty is older now than a bunch of last year's high school draftees are right now. He's almost 20. He's 2 years older than Kyren Paris. They're both high school seniors. And at this age, and it's surprisingly influential for college players as well, but for teenagers, teenage bodies who have had 2 years, a year and a half more time to develop and mature physically, if they're competing against one another, one of them is going to perform better than the other most of the time. It is a huge thing for someone. So I think, yeah, Rainey Jazzierli published studies on age in relationship to the draft a long time ago, and I think some teams maybe have overcorrected. I think that you have to look at it in context. There are young individuals who are physically not very young. Simeon Woods Richardson, who was 17 on draft day last year, the Mets took him pretty early. He was not physically mature, even though he was 17. So there are some context dependent mm-hmm. things I think teams need to adjust manually. But it is a big deal. Teams do consider it heavily. As it relates to Bobby Witt and Brett Beatty, I just think they're both really good prospects. We consider the age, we definitely round it down, especially on Beatty, because of the age, but still, in my opinion, worthy of where they were drafted.
Yeah. Well, the Mets fans on staff will be happy to hear that. One thing that I wanted to ask, this seems to get brought up every year that there's, the draft happens during the NCAA tournament. There's, the thing that comes to mind is, I was covering the Vanderbilt, Illinois Super Regional when three kids from that game went in the top 10 and the draft happened right after the game ended. Chase Stump from UCLA got drafted while he was on deck in the regional final last night and homered three pitches later, which was, that made for good TV, but it also happened at midnight on the East Coast. And I'm curious, this gets, you think about the hype for the NFL draft or the NBA draft, and the MLB draft is just sort of an afterthought. And to a certain extent, I don't really think that's avoidable because the college season's still going on. And there's, these prospects are not going to be on a major league. Rutschman is an incredible prospect. He's probably not going to make it to the big leagues until the end of next year at the very, very earliest. So how is there a way to hype this up, do you think, and still make it report on it responsibly while making it intelligible to casual fans who might just have MLB Network on in the background?
Right. They are swimming upstream because of the way things work with players' timeline to the big leagues, and college baseball and, you know, high school baseball are not prominent on television. High school baseball is not on there at all. So it is hard to have an interesting, and I guess at the same time, right, like during the NBA draft years when high school players were eligible, there was still a lot of hype over a bunch of them. So maybe that's not a great
excuse.
And
not even like LeBron. Like, we all knew who Kevin Garnett was, or Tyson Chandler, you know? That's...
Yeah, or Sebastian Telfair, like guys who aren't... Yeah, it's not... You don't have to be a generational talent to be famous as a high schooler when you're playing basketball. I don't know. Some of it's probably cultural. Some of it is probably the timing of the thing. I think an interesting nugget would be to make all the picks tradable. That would be chaotic in a way that would be very stressful for me, but it would be so much fun. And if that's the case, then if you're a Cubs fan, then theoretically, like, you could be in play for Adley Rutschman. Or if you're the Orioles, or, you know, any of these teams who are undergoing a rebuild, like, let's say you're the Giants, you pick 10, but you're in desperate need of talent ahead of that, arguably. Then you could, like, start flipping. Like, imagine if the Giants traded big league assets for, you know, picks in the middle of the first round. Think about what the Brewers did with one of their comp picks. They traded pick, was it 41, to Texas for Alex Claudio. Like, that's a competitive big league team valuing a good middle reliever with the 41st pick in the draft. Like, you can kind of triangulate where some of the other picks would fall on the value continuum. You know, like, some of these competitive teams who are looking right now, like, to win. Imagine the Phillies, if 14 is there and you're the Phillies and someone is like, hey, here's a pitcher, you know, like, here's a number four starter for you for the next 4 months. Like, that's kind of an enticing thing, you know?
I agree with you. I think that would be incredibly interesting for us, but, and maybe, like, there is just a ceiling to how interesting you can make this, that only the lunatics who are, you know, who read or produce, you know, draft coverage or are super into college baseball will ever find this interesting. But, like, I don't know if you couldn't get a number four starter for the 14th pick, could you? Like, this is, I don't know if these assets are, you know, if these are, like, good enough assets to move somebody better than, like, an Alex Claudio.
Well, I guess it this time
unless
of year,
it's like moving up and down for Rutschman, because I will say, like, this, sorry to cut you off, but, like, the prospects I found interesting, you know, as a Phillies fan at 14, I was like, well, nobody I really love is going to end up there, so I didn't really pay that close attention, or I wouldn't have paid that close attention. Whereas if there was a chance of them going up to get, like, Alec Manoah or Lodolo or somebody like that, then, you know, there would have been an incentive to at least tune in. But yeah, sorry.
No, it's okay. Like, I think at this time of year, there's less, like, teams are more polarized as to how they're operating on the competitive continuum. There are teams who just know they're done, and then there are teams who think they have a chance to make the playoffs and contend this season. And those teams are just motivated they're to behave differently than the ones who are, like, have not. So yeah, like, it's, you can kind of do an asset value calc and get pretty close to what it is. You know, we have a 45 plus future value on Bryson Stott. That's basically, like, you know, a number four or five starter, or low end regular, like, someone who has a chance that has some more upside than that, but there are problems. Like, Stott's swing is kind of weird. He might not stay at shortstop. So it's like, realistically, this is a low-end regular, but there's also upside. And so, like, to flip a guy at 14 who profiles that way for a big leaguer right now who profiles that way, you know, on a team that's not contending, imagine, you know, a bad team has a big leaguer who is a 45-plus, you know, like, asset. That just makes sense. Like, it's like a Nash equilibrium thing where you have these minor league talents who are going to be big leaguers in 3, 4, 5 years. And then you have big leaguers on teams who aren't going to be competitive for another 3, 4, 5 years. Like, those teams have incentive to flip the big leaguer for the guy who better fits with their competitive timeline. Like some of this stuff is happening now, thinking like this is pervasive across front offices. I think that we'd have a lot of action on draft night if picks were tradable.
Yeah, I don't necessarily disagree with that. I just don't, you know, I wonder if there's a ceiling to how much. But anyway, we're talking about game theory and formal modeling, and we're also way over time. So I think it's time for me to let you get back to work. Or like go to sleep, whichever is going to get you through the day. But thanks for taking 20 minutes to come and talk.
Sure, dude. Anytime.
Support for today's show comes from Sonos. Sonos meticulously designs every speaker from the inside out. Their experts in acoustics and engineering even work with Oscar and Grammy-winning producers, mixers, and artists to ensure an immersive listening experience. Getting started is easy. Just plug in your speaker and open the app and connect all your favorite streaming services. Start with one speaker and connect more over Wi-Fi whenever you're ready. All Sonos speakers and components work together so you can customize your sound system. You can also connect your TV or turntable to listen to everything you love. Setup is just like that. It's plug and play. No tangles of wires, no confusing panel of switches. It's intuitive. Once it's plugged in, the sound quality is remarkable. I was watching a movie over the weekend and you can just feel the bass. So if that sounds good to you, go to Sonos.com to learn more. You will know my next guest from his work on The Ringer and his second full-length baseball book, which comes out today, Ben Lindbergh. Congratulations. Hi.
Thank you very much. It's my second co-written full-length baseball book, so I guess that adds up to one full baseball book, but I'll take it.
We can hopefully call you a multiple best-selling author by the
That'd
the
be
end
nice.
Of this. Yeah. So I've received a copy of your book in the mail, as well as a list from your publisher's publicist of topics that I could talk to you and or your co-author Travis Sawchuk about.
I haven't even seen that list. I don't even know what I'm qualified to talk about.
Do you want to read some of this? One of the things that like, do you want to do the James Lipton style interview? Do you want to do like the Letterman interview? Because one thing that I've always loved is like when the late night hosts, and this is not going to translate to podcast medium, like they take the album as the band is coming on stage and like slam it down on the desk.
Yeah,
I'm doing that right now in my office. So anyway, yeah, the book is called The MVP Machine. And let's see, we could talk about why the Moneyball era is over and what strategies the best players and teams in baseball are using now. So that seems like a good place to start, except I'm going to start with I have to say my favorite part of the book. I did not realize that you would be doing partial nudity for this book. You take your shirt off at the Driveline Baseball headquarters.
I did not realize that either when I set out to write this book. Yeah, I said in the book, I mean, I wanted to get part of the first person experience in the book, because this is a book all about player development and how players are getting better and the technologies and the training that they're using. And so I figured, well, I can write about what these players are going through, and I will, and I'll include their testimony, but I'd better experience some of this firsthand just to get some sense of what it's like and what the potential is. Not that I'm going to come out of this as a big leaguer, but, you know, firsthand experience. And then, yes, much to my dismay, I show up at Driveline Baseball, the independent training facility in Seattle. And not only do I have to strip down and get all of these markers, these bulbs attached to my body, 47 of these little plastic doohickeys stuck all over my body so that I could then get on a mound and throw, and they could track all of my movements with 15 cameras. And so all of my inadequacies were quantified to a degree of detail that I didn't really need in my life necessary. And meanwhile, all of these like pro players are like Kyle Zimmer standing around watching me strip down and throw from a mound, which I am not that great at doing. I was a second baseman in my own brief playing career. I was not known for my arm. So there was a lot of prostrating ourselves before actual athletes here and kind of getting our comeuppance. And it was a humbling experience, but also an eye-opening one, because it really is kind of inspirational and you know, interesting when you can try out all these new tools and you get a sense of, oh, okay, this is why all of this stuff is happening now. And this is why players are transforming their careers, because this technology was not available 5 years ago, and it really does make a difference.
Yeah, that was one of, I think, the most, if so, listeners to this podcast will recognize a lot of the names in the book. I mean, Travis was on when he wrote Big Data Baseball, and we talked about some of the issues with wearable stuff. Kyle Bodie's been on this podcast. Doug Ladd has been on this podcast. Craig Breslow and a bunch of the other people who figure prominently in this in this narrative. There is like a unified idea, but it's a series of vignettes, really, rather than just like one story the way Moneyball is the story of the 2002 A's.
Yeah.
But anyway, what I was going to say is what that chapter got us. I think it was my favorite part of the book was when you described your road to Damascus moment when Doug Ladd is teaching you how to hit. And like, this is one of the most fascinating things in baseball to me right now is this moment when it just clicks. I can't even remember how many players who have made a big velocity leap or made a swing change, and like it all just comes together and like in the space of a day, sometimes within the space of a few pitches, they just figure it all out, and all of a sudden they're throwing harder, they're hitting the ball harder. And this happened to you. And I think you captured that feeling pretty well, but it's just, I can't imagine having experienced that firsthand.
Yeah, it was like suddenly acquiring superpowers or something. Like, not that I'm that great all of a sudden, but I went to the same hitting coach who tutored Justin Turner and, Hunter Pence more recently. And we have Turner talking about this in the book, how he just kind of changed his mindset and changed his mechanics. And one day in batting practice, he just tried out the new style and suddenly he was hitting bombs that he never hit before. And I sort of had the same experience. Like, hitting has been my strong suit, if you can call it that, as a player, like in a relative sense. But once I worked with Doug, with this guy who's had this sort of effect on other major league players, I could really see how it happens. And that has been the whole intoxicating part of this topic to me and why I wanted to work on this book, is that we've seen so many players go through this sort of transformation. And for me, it was Rich Hill, I think, who really opened my mind to the idea that this could be done, because here's a 35-year-old player who's been bouncing around the big leagues and the minors and indie ball. And suddenly he comes out of nowhere and he's one of the best pitchers in baseball because he changed his pitch mix and he started throwing his curveball more. And that was mind-blowing for me, because I thought if you were going to become a big leaguer and actually stay in the big leagues, you had to have maxed out your talent. Like, you must have been doing everything you could to get yourself to that point, because it's such a competitive field. And yet we've seen the Hills and the Turners and the JD Martinez's get to the big leagues and then have a higher gear than that. And if they can do that, then certainly minor leaguers and amateur ball players can do that. And if players who are already at the pinnacle of their profession can get that much better at it, then maybe we can all get better at podcasting or whatever it is. Even like podcasting, I mean, I've been doing that for several years now, and I feel like I've gotten better at that in the way that players get better at improving their swings or something. Not that I'm like a all-star level podcaster, but I edited my podcast tracks for years, and so I would see every and ah and thinking sound.
I think I've stopped saying
right
just over the course of this season. Not stopped, but
Just hearing yourself say those things and saving yourself some time in editing after the fact. Once those flaws are pointed out to you, you can actually change them. And that's what's happening with players these days, because every batting practice session, every bullpen session, they have everything tracked so that you can see in real time as you're making improvements from pitch to pitch, from swing to swing. And that's really powerful, because you can identify these weaknesses. And once you do, once you can analyze what you're doing in greater detail, you can then change it.
Right. And that's what's fascinating to me about this whole thing is, like, this is the, I would say, the definitive on-field story in baseball, maybe over the past 5 years.
I think so, yeah.
And the ability to the rapid advances in player development. And so I think that one thing that this book relies heavily on interviews with Kyle Bodie from Driveline and Trevor Bauer, which makes sense because Driveline is the most famous and outspoken private baseball tutor going right now, and Bauer is their most famous and outspoken pupil. Yeah. And they both of them talk a lot about Bauer not being a good athlete, which I think is it's an interesting thing to hear them say, because what matters for athleticism, it's strength and speed and stuff like that for a pitcher, but they talk about him not being athletic and just his ability to change his to change his delivery, to have that awareness of the way his body is working. That strikes me as an important physical gift, and that I think they might be underselling.
True. I mean, he isn't gifted in the sense that, you know, evidently he has a low testosterone level and he's not the fastest or the strongest, or he doesn't look like he works out, even though he does, that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. But he does have this, I guess you could call it a sixth tool or something, which is that he is extremely dedicated, like to an obsessive degree about everything he does, you know, to his detriment sometimes when we're talking about his tweets, for instance. But when we're talking about baseball, he will practice in this really focused way, and he has brought every tool to bear that he possibly could, and he made himself into a Cy Young caliber player last season. And so I think a lot of teams will be targeting that type of ability. I don't know whether that many players have the Trevor Bauer mentality or whether you'd want that many players with exactly the Trevor Bauer mentality, but that determination to make yourself better and to bring in all of the tools that you can in order to do that, I think that will be more and more important, which is not to say talent doesn't still matter, but I think it is more malleable than was believed before. And that's kind of the whole central thesis of the book. The Moneyball era and all the books in the Moneyball mold, including my previous one and Travis's previous one, were all about identifying pre-existing talent that was undervalued by the market. So you could see that Scott Hatterberg was worth something because he walked a lot. And so you could go sign Scott Hatterberg, but you weren't making Scott Hatterberg walk a lot. You weren't taking anyone who wasn't good at things and making them better at things. And that's where the real competitive advantage seems to be these days, is not finding talent, because every team is doing a really good job of that these days, but creating or enhancing talent. And certain players have a talent for enhancing their own talent. It's maybe a mental thing or something in their brain more so than a physical thing that can easily be quantified, but it's really important.
So there are two branches off that discussion that, or off that idea that I want to pursue. The first one is, going into this, I actually was a little apprehensive that, so you mentioned Moneyball and, you know, and Travis's book, Big Data Baseball, and the Extra 2%, and all these books that we loved that were, you know, they put forth like this, you know, this revolutionary ideas of what teams could do. And I don't, there's books like that tend not to age well, not only because the state of the art changes so quickly. You know, we talk about the state of baseball statistics and whatever, every 3 or 4 months, whenever we just don't have anything else to talk about on this pod, you and I, but we're in stage like 4 or 5 of the post Moneyball sabermetric or baseball world. Mm-hmm. And so the state of the art changes, but also with that comes all sorts of unanticipated consequences in terms of the morality or ethics of generalizing some of this stuff. And I think one of the things that I really liked that you did was you made an effort to predict in some places or evaluate or to take stock of what does this mean? Where could this go? And what are the pitfalls ahead of the sport or the society, you know, as these ideas and practices develop.
Yeah, this movement we think is really riveting, and we think it's great that certain players have improved their own careers and changed their trajectories and kind of like taken back agency in their own careers after years of just teams sort of sorting them from afar and deciding this guy's good and that guy's not good. Players are now taking control of their own careers and saying, I can be better. But there are some unintended side effects and consequences, and we wanted to get into that in the book. So there are a few things. I think, A, there's the privacy concern. So especially in the minor leagues where teams can kind of impose technology on players, they don't have the same protections that major leaguers do. And so if you're a minor leaguer nowadays, you're being tracked. Everything you do is being measured and quantified, and your sleep is being monitored and your nutrition. And yes, maybe that's making you better if you embrace it and say, well, I could be better at this, but it's also a bit invasive and we wouldn't like that in our own work lives. And, you know, there's the potential for some player to lose out in the long run because of something that kind of monitoring uncovers. And then at the major league level, you have the whole economic destabilization that we have talked about on this podcast and written about, where teams are not paying for free agents anymore. That's for multiple reasons, but part of it is that they think they can do such a good job of developing players now that they don't have to go pay a premium for the 29-year-old two-win guy on the free agent market. They can just sign some generic equivalent who doesn't have the same track record, but maybe has some raw skills that can be molded so that he provides the same production for less money. Or you can promote a prospect who's not getting paid under the current economic system. And then there's also the concern that we've talked about the game on the field and the spectator experience and the strikeouts and the home runs and the breaking balls. And all of that stuff is being exacerbated by these player development techniques because those are the optimal things for players to strive for. And players are getting better at achieving those optimal individual results. But in some cases, they are not optimal for the sport and for spectators. So these are all concerns that may lead to changes in the CBA. They may lead to rules changes, but I don't think it's going to fix itself. It doesn't seem like a cyclical thing that's just going to swing back the other way without intervention.
Mm-hmm. And it's the book, it feels, is positive on a lot of these innovations that are changing the game in the way you describe. But I'm glad that that you took the time to be at least a little bit ambivalent about this stuff.
Because there are cheerleaders and rah-rah and technology is great because there are costs that come with that. I should also mention the economic disparities sometimes, like for kids who are getting into the game. And if you have access to TrackMan and these other technologies, then you have a leg up on the kid who doesn't. And that's already a concern where you have kids who can't pay for travel ball and they can't keep up with their more privileged competitors. And it's possible that that gap will only widen now.
So the other thing that I wanted to talk about off that is, so some of the ideas that in terms of swing plane, or like you go back and talk about, you quote Ted Williams, who is an incredibly, or I guess was, assuming we don't unfreeze him and clone him Futurama style, who was an incredibly thoughtful and interesting writer about hitting and student of hitting. And a lot of his ideas, you know, Charlie Lau, you talked about a lot about the Royals, you go back to Branch Rickey. These are not necessarily all new ideas. And that's a recurring theme of the era of advanced analysis, is that as the data gets better, we discover that some of the old conventional wisdom is true. And this cyclical nature, like, it goes back to talking about Trevor Bauer's gift being driven. Like, that just sounds like grit and want under like a cyber futurist techno libertarian vocabulary. You know, everything, there is a lot of everything old is new again. And we just have the data to prove it now.
Right. And we used to make fun of a lot of that stuff. We used to, you know, gritty David Eckstein and everything, but maybe he actually was as good as he was, despite not being physically imposing, because he had some extra drive or practice aptitude that was getting him to that point. So, yeah, I mean, that's kind of a theme of I guess, my baseball writing in general, is just everything new is old to some extent. And we don't realize it because baseball has been around for 150 years of professional sports. And so a lot of this stuff is sort of lost to time. And there were things that I uncovered while working on this book that were really striking parallels to what's happening today and precursors to this movement. But for various reasons, they just kind of remained in isolated pockets and they didn't catch on, because you had the baseball men who were very opposed to this, and you didn't have the front office that was sympathetic to these ideas, and you didn't have the technology in many cases that makes it much easier to actually implement some of these practices. So I do go over Branch Rickey and the Royals Academy and all of these things that I think kind of augured where we were going, but the baseball just wasn't ready for those ideas yet. And I think it's only in the past few years that the sport's really embraced it in earnest.
All right. Well, let me ask you this before we go. Is there something that like got left out, or some experience you had researching this? Because this had to be just a totally different experience from your first book, where you were hands-on in one place. Now this is much more a work of journalism than a work of science or expectation, or
very much
not
so.
Expectation, experimentation, the way the first one was.
Yeah, it was much harder to report this, to figure out how to structure it, because it's a really broad topic, the player development in baseball, the past, present, and future. It's not like The Only Rule or Big Data Baseball, where it's just the story of one team and this, you know, executive who figured out this one weird trick to be good at baseball. And a lot of books are in that mold, but this one was, it was hard to know where to go. And everything is researched or queried and not, you know, you can't just kind of muse on your own for a page or two the way I could in the previous book. So I think, honestly, we ended up with too much material. I mean, we were worried at the start, who will talk to us? Will we actually get anything here? And then we got so much that we had to trim it down in the end. And I don't think anything got left out that I'm really sorry to see go. But what was tough was just figuring out how many examples of each thing we needed, because I felt like I wanted every example of every player who has made some sort of data-driven change to be in the book, because like it backs up the thesis.
That's how I think too. I don't want to leave anything on the cutting room floor.
Right. It's like, A, I did the work and I want to show that I did the work. That's just kind of an ego thing. But more than that, it's like, well, we're making the case that player development is the big movement in baseball right now. So the more examples of that I show in the book, the more persuasive it will be. And maybe that's true, but it kind of backfires, because once you go through one pitch design session or one hitter changing his swing or elevating his fastball or all these varieties of this type of change, you know, you see it once, you kind of know what it looks like. And so we ended up cutting examples of players who did something similar to the more interesting or prominent example that was detailed in the book. So some of that stuff was left on the cutting room floor, but I don't think any ideas or concepts or insights were. I think we were relieved with how it came together, because as you said, it's hard to figure out how to structure this and have it be a narrative and a story that actually like flows from chapter to chapter. And readers will be the judge of whether we accomplished that, but I hope we did a decent job.
I will say I did find myself, we talk about like changing your swing plane or changing the grip on a pitch. The level of, I read large portions of this like with an imaginary baseball in my hand. Yeah. Like at one point you were describing one of the driveline drills that Bauer was doing, and like I stood up and
I
had
a lot of that.
And so there's a lot of precision and description in this that I think makes it helps illustrate a lot of the stuff that we talk about in an 800 word article or a 2000 word article, but you just can't get that level of detail unless you go to 300 odd pages. So I really hope it's
approachable in that way, because there are all these concepts and like mechanical concepts and technological devices. Mm-hmm. And we're not like mechanical experts. Like Travis and I can't go and fix someone's swing. And so we're kind of trying to understand the concepts well enough to communicate them to people. And so you kind of have to get it, but you also have to put it in language that the average reader can understand and that we ourselves could understand.
Yeah.
I hope so. But yeah, you want to illustrate this with examples, but you don't want to get so bogged down in details that everyone's like, okay, that's enough.
So my recommendation to the listener slash hopefully reader is pick up this book and read it in a room where you have enough space to stand up and actually, you know, do some of these movements. The book is The MVP Machine with Ben and Travis Sawchuk, How Baseball's New Nonconformists Are Using Data to Build Better Players. It is on sale as of today, Tuesday.
Yes.
You're going to have a book signing at Foley's in New York, mm-hmm. correct?
Yes, 6:30 Eastern on Tuesday.
Yep. Well, we'll ask Bobby, who did some transcription work for this, right?
Yes, he did. Yeah, he was very helpful.
So we'll try to get Bobby to have this up in time for you to get through the podcast and two Foley's by 6:30. But if you miss out on that, you can find this book wherever fine books are sold. Also, there's an excerpt on the site, the Astros chapter, correct?
Mm-hmm.
Or a portion of the Astros chapter.
Of it. Yep. Mm-hmm.
So if you want a free sample of, a pretty exhaustive book on what I think we both agree is the most important ongoing story in baseball right now, you can go head to that and go pick up the book afterwards. So I enjoyed it. I read it essentially in one sitting.
All right. Well, thank you very much. I'm glad you liked it.
All right. We'll talk to you. We'll figure out. You're not writing another book before next week.
I don't have another book coming out next week. So
talk again about
back to the drawing board.
Yeah, we'll talk again about how to fill out this segment of the podcast before next week. But anyway, congratulations. Right, we'll talk to you later.
Thank you.
That will just about do it for this week's edition of the Ringer MLB Show. Thanks as always to Zach and Ben for joining me today. Thanks also to my special guest, Eric Longenhagen. You can find his work at Fangraphs, where he makes frequent appearances on Fangraphs Audio as part of the Untitled McDongenhagen Project podcast with Kyla McDaniel. You can also find him on Twitter at Longenhagen. Thanks, as always, to Bobby Wagner for producing today's episode. Thanks to Jay Bruce, Adley Rutschman, Ben Lindbergh, and Travis Sawchick for giving us stuff to talk about today. And thank you for listening. Enjoy the week's action, and we'll see you next time.